welcome to the Amber Data Derivatives Podcast. I'm here with Louis Fellas, who is the head of hedge fund divisions over at CoinShares. Louis, how are you?
Hey, good. Thanks for having me on today.
Yeah, absolutely. Been wanting to do this. I'm glad we finally got to it. So it's great to have you on. So maybe we could start off with CoinShares for anyone who's new to CoinShares or hasn't heard about CoinShares. Maybe we could just get a brief history and kind of an overview of what CoinShares does today.
Yeah, sure. So CoinShares has been around for a pretty long time in a number of different formats. So originally it was founded by Danny Masters, Russ Newton, as a commodity trading hedge fund in the 90s. And the guys were quite visionary and saw Bitcoin when it emerged very early on. And in 2014, they set up, I think it's probably the world's first regulated Bitcoin fund in Jersey in the Channel Islands. And since then, they've went on to build a number of different products. They acquired XBT Provider out of Sweden, and they moved very aggressively into the ETP industry. And I think that industry position has grown. I think today we're about just over 5 billion in ETPs in Europe. So it's the largest digital asset manager in Europe. And 2016-17, I set up my own crypto hedge fund, Bletchley Park Asset Management. And when I was moving around the world trying to find out where can you run a pioneering crypto fund, I looked at the work the guys had done at CoinShares and kind of piggybacked on that. And so I then moved from Hong Kong to Jersey and the Channel Islands and set up my own hedge fund. And so our paths have crossed a number of times. And then I guess, yeah, I sold my business in 2020. And then about a year and a half ago, started speaking again with the founders about, you know, some collaboration ideas and maybe how could I do something that was complementary to what they were already doing. And so we came about the idea of creating a hedge fund division to kind of build hedge funds internally, seed them, incubate them, and get it going, and then provide these dedicated investment strategies to funds, so to investors rather.
Oh, that's really fascinating. So kind of big picture, CoinShares has been around for a while. They had a futures commodities trading business, and then they just saw the birth of Bitcoin as like another asset class with a lot of opportunity. That's really interesting. And so now that you run the hedge fund division within CoinShares, what does that mean exactly? Is that like there's going to be a bunch of different subset hedge funds with targeted strategies? Is that how that works?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, hedge funds in these days, we typically see the headlines around a lot of the multi-strats where people have built these kind of things combining a bit of event trading, some options trading, some HFTs, and some events. And, you know, from my experience in crypto, if you create a multi-strat, it's a bit of a compromise in that your investors have different demands in crypto. Some of them really want the VC element. Some of them can see that there's a lot of opportunity in the arbitrage and that pure alpha. So they don't want the market beta. And then others just want the market beta. And so, you know, our view when we created Hedge Fund Solutions was to build really segmented funds. And so if you want a multi-strat, invest in all our funds. You'll get a multi-strat. But at the same time, if you want an alpha overlay on your BTC or ETH, we've got a product for that. And then we're building a kind of a relative value equity long short fund, which is trading crypto related stocks versus non crypto stocks coming in Q1 or end of Q1.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So we've got a roadmap of about six different hedge funds that we think we might launch over the next 2 years. And we're just going to see where the market takes us, see where the demand is.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And how do you view like crypto as an asset class having, you know, how important is active management versus just regular beta exposure for this type of asset class? Is it similar to traditional markets or does it have its own like nuances that we wouldn't see elsewhere?
Yeah, I think it does. I think the differentiation between the alpha and the beta within crypto is just so much higher. In today's market, you know, what is a good level of alpha that you can get or generate as an absolute return fund? And I mean, when I talk about that, it has to be at scale. You know, I see a lot of people sending me portfolios of $100,000 and they're making 100% return. That's great. But, you know, when we look at scalable alpha, we have to think, okay, can we run this with 100, 200, 300 million and still hit those same numbers? And the problem, well, not the problem, but the interesting thing about crypto is the beta is so high. In terms of what do we expect Bitcoin to do over a year versus what do we expect S&P to do. And so that means when you start combining alpha and beta to build a to build an investment product, the beta will always outweigh the alpha if you have any of it in your portfolio. And so that's something I learned early on in my crypto journey, like 2017, where we were trying to build a product where the alpha overlay would really defend against the beta swings. No, you know, the beta is way bigger than the alpha. So that's an interesting thing. You know, in normal finance, in S&P, if S&P is doing, you know, 10% a year and you can generate 15% alpha, that's great. You know, you can manage that beta a lot better. So in crypto, I think you have to be a lot more selective about how you manage those risks and kind of flagging them to your investors as well. Because, you know, and sometimes the alpha will get hit by the beta, whether it's like an FTX type situation or something hits the market pretty hard, and your alpha strategies will become beta anyway. So
Yeah.
it's a tough one.
That's a really interesting nuance because you could have, and I've always said this about the crypto vol market, there's so much edge there, but even if you made 80% in a year of like pure delta neutral, real, just capturing edge, but Bitcoin does 10x, no one's going to give you like a trophy for making 80% on your delta neutral strategy. But on the flip
Yeah.
side, you could just be sitting in cash and crypto has a huge pullback and goes down 90%. But no one's going to give you a pat on the back for avoiding the whole bear market. So it's really interesting that the beta
Yeah.
component being so big overshadows a lot of like the true edge alpha that in traditional markets people are heavily rewarded by. So that's a really interesting insight. You mentioned that CoinShares has a lot of strategies in ETPs, exchange traded products. Obviously, you guys have more ETPs in Europe. But we just started getting some good ones here in the US. How do you expect that to change the landscape? Or do you expect it to just be kind of business as usual now that we have this spot Bitcoin ETF?
Yeah, we could talk for an hour. It could be the entire podcast could be on this. You know, I think CoinShares, we have about 25 ETPs, and you know, these are passive beta products. And so again, we try and deliver you know, the best cost in these products with the best custody. We complement them with research. So if you're buying an ETP from us or you're interacting with us, it's not like we're just selling you this kind of white label product. It's something that we've spent years building. And you know, you can speak with our research analyst to make sure that you understand the nuances of that investment. But thinking about the U.S., and then in the U.S., CoinShares is actually, I think we're close to finalizing our purchase of Valkyrie, the ETF provider as
Oh,
well.
wow.
So that's an interesting thing for us to get a footprint in the U.S. market. But I think the ETFs are going to change the market just massively. You know, I think the volumes we've seen, I think it was $589 million of inflows last week into the ETPs in the US. You know, I'm frequently looking at the volume that these things are trading. And I think we're going to see the ETP or the ETF business, I would imagine within 6 months, will be trading more volume than the spot market.
Interesting.
And I would guess as well. You know, derivatives are a great exchange for trading derivatives, and we can see OKX is coming through with some derivatives, and the CME contracts haven't really got a lot of volume going yet. But I think when we get options on the BlackRock ETF, which they've filed for, you know, that's going to be the next game changer. And for a guy like myself who likes to trade arbitrage and also find out these kind of little differences within pricing, that's going to be great. Right, you're going to get a lot of price discovery when you have three different options markets you can trade against. You know, what does that mean for the volatility skew term structure? Hard to call right now.
Yeah, that's a really interesting insight. I share that sentiment. To me, the ETF listed options is really the 10x moment for open interest growth
Yeah.
in the crypto option space. I know one of the sort of the peculiar points of this is that for the first time now, prime brokers have available balance sheet for equity options, which that's all it is. It's just another equity option. So players will have access to some of that balance sheet to trade these markets. So that's kind of a new side aspect from the spot Bitcoin ETF. So one of the things that you've mentioned is that you expect that the spot Bitcoin ETF is going to really change the landscape, and there's going to be huge volumes in the Bitcoin spot ETF that overtake the volumes of spot markets. You also mentioned that you guys trade like equity, crypto related equities versus other equities. One of the things I found interesting for Coinbase is that Coinbase had a lot of a huge rally into this spot Bitcoin ETF because they're a big custodian. But also, the spot Bitcoin ETF is actually going to be a lot of competition for Coinbase is spot market activity. Is that something you've looked at all, that type of effect on Coinbase as a crypto equity?
Yeah, you're right. It's a little bit of a paradox in that, you know, they are effectively providing the services that will cannibalize their own business. So, you know, we would need to know a little bit more about, you know, what are those custodial fees? How much money can they make? Are they less worried about the commissions, which is always a race to zero with these businesses? And I think the commissions in crypto have been high for a long time, and that's going to get ground down pretty quickly now. You've got these ETFs. But they've got a great brand, got great positioning. So I think it's hard to say whether it's bullish or bearish. I just think it's going to change their model and how they interact with these ETFs. And it might lead to a fragmentation or a splitting out of different business units over there as they have to separate out, create greater, more of a Chinese wall between the custody business where they're providing leverage and these ancillary services. They may need to straighten that out. But, you know, when I look at things like Coinbase, it's one of the best names to trade along with MicroStrategy, where you see some really interesting dislocations in the implied vol markets or, you know, on the calls on Coinbase versus calls on Bitcoin. The correlation's there, but the vol differentials sometimes are enormous. That's a great trading opportunity.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And we saw that in Q4, the beta for Coinbase actually outperformed sort of the Bitcoin and Ethereum altogether. So that was kind of an interesting thing. Do you guys look at the mining stocks as well, like Mara, things like that? To me, that seems like an interesting opportunity as well.
Yeah, definitely. You know, we've got a really good research team. I think there's four of them on the research team, four guys, and they have a joint venture product with Invesco. I think we track around, it's got about $600 million in it today. And that's kind of a crypto index, and it has mining stocks within it, it has Coinbase. It's kind of a broad-based long-only product for crypto. So I speak with that team quite frequently, and we definitely look at the miners and kind of try and understand their cost of production, see where their operational leverage is. And again, when we see options and structures emerging around that, sometimes it's convertible bonds can offer some really good asymmetry. And I think there's some interesting reasons why these assets trade cheap and why the opportunity exists. And from what we've seen, a lot of the TradFi players that would normally provide leverage to the hedge funds out there just won't provide leverage on crypto-related stocks or convertible bonds. Mm. So they're kind of under-owned, but maybe it's harder for a hedge fund to own it when it's very capital inefficient. And that leads to a price discounting from where we think fair value is. So as crypto specialists, we look at these things and think, wow, they're cheap.
Yeah, that's fantastic. That's like a source of alpha, and we can see the capital constraint that creates that source of alpha. Do you view... Yeah. We touched on the beta earlier. Do you view crypto as having more alpha opportunities than traditional markets as well?
Yeah, I think so. I think the size of those alpha opportunities is there. And it's quite funny, back in 2017 when I was marketing my first fund, and we were talking about the futures premium discount and that alpha. And you know, I would go into pitch meetings and people were like, yeah, that's going to be gone within 6 months. You know, Millennium are going to come in and just crunch that to zero. Yeah, all right. 7 years later, CME front month futures still trading 13, 14% annualized. Mm-hmm. Last week, it was 20%. And so the alpha still exists because, you know, it's an inefficient market. And I think that retail flows sometimes, you know, it's hard for people to dynamically adjust to make the market efficient. You know, there's just more inefficient money coming into the market than there is efficient money.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So, speaking of the past 7 years, what do we see over the next 5 or 10 years? Kind of what is your, maybe not a price prediction, but what like sort of a sector of crypto are you most excited by? Is it NFTs? Is it L1s? Is it L2s? Is it crypto derivatives? Things like that.
It's probably crypto derivatives. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm really, 10 years is far too long to make a prediction in crypto. But, you know, I think when I look at Bitcoin, I think the narrative is always changing. You know, is it a payment mechanism? Is it a store of value? And I think when you look it up in an ETF, it's no longer a payment mechanism, right? Because it's just stuck there with a custodian. So it's really proving out that store of value narrative. And so I'm interested to kind of to see where that journey goes, right? So it's a store of value, but you know, what's going to be driving? Is it going to be central bank monetary policy? Is it going to become correlated to gold? If it does become that kind of digital gold, will it have the volatility characteristics of gold? Mm-hmm. I.e. it's going to drop from kind of where we are today in the 50s down to maybe the low 20s. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. And I think with gold, yes, it's something that you can relatively easily buy, but you can buy Bitcoin way easier than you can buy gold, way easier to custody. Mm-hmm. And so again, it could have this unique characteristic. So I think that journey to me is going to be really interesting from that. Kind of a macroeconomic perspective. The opportunity, I think, is derivatives. And when we look at the open interest in derivatives on S&P and NASDAQ, we know it dwarfs the underlying markets. And so I think crypto has a huge amount of growth ahead of it in that space. And that's something we're really going to be focused on. You know, L1, L2s, L2s obviously with the scaling, I think there's going to be a lot of opportunity there where people are going to be able to go off, develop something, bring it to market. And, you know, trying to scale something that's already live is always hard, whereas you can incubate these things and come through. And so I think if you're looking for the 1,000x returns, it's probably still going to be in the L2s and these kind of ancillary projects. Not something I get a lot of time to look at. You know, I'm very much market focused, but it's something where I'm very, very much watching it. And I think to that extent, you know, DeFi is definitely, as I see it, is the future. I think we're on this kind of convergent pathway where we're kind of getting a little bit of crypto into TradFi, and TradFi is getting a little bit into crypto, and hopefully we end up using a lot of blockchain solutions as the underlying as they become some of the governance issues are addressed, we get more scalability, and I think DeFi is going to be very much part of that solution.
Yeah, that's a really interesting aspect. DeFi and real world assets to me seem like an interesting marriage. We have things such as you know, real estate purchases in the real world that are tokenized on chain and people can invest in those. I expect the collectibles market to have really interesting characteristics in the DeFi space. Is real world assets something that you think makes sense as well in going into the future of crypto?
Yeah, definitely. I think that was what really got me into crypto back in, I guess, 2016, when I could see how you could begin to tokenize these assets and improve the efficiency of ownership and transferability. I thought, wow, this is going to be amazing. I thought, you know, within 2 years, we're going to see tokenized equities. It was pretty early, pretty wrong. You know, and I think in hindsight, you know, the thing to remember, like health and wealth are the two most heavily regulated things in the world. And so getting wealth, i.e. securities, regulated and getting them on chain is just going to take a lot longer than people imagine. So I think you can have a great tech solution, but getting it through to work with the regulators. And also, I think the amazing thing about crypto is that it's global in nature. And so it's really hard for a single regulator to police, you know, a real world asset that's going to be trading 24/7 across, you know, globally. How do you begin to create a regulatory structure for that? So I think real world assets, absolutely, it's the future, but it's got a long journey and unfortunately a lot of interaction with the regulators to come.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's an interesting insight as well. It's a little bit of a paradox. Decentralization is great for individual ownership, but the global nature of crypto is kind of a globalization effect as well. So there's a little bit of a competing interest there. Cool. Well, thanks, Lewis. I want to jump in a little bit about your background. You have a really interesting background. You prop traded at Lehman Brothers. I'd love to touch on that and maybe just hear some of your stories there. How was that?
It was interesting. You know, I started my career at JP Morgan back in 2000 in London, and that was great. I mean, you know, I think back in that era, you know, you would work in an investment bank and you would just get this really good grounding where they would invest in teaching you about trading, risk management, derivatives. And so it's kind of almost like going back to university for the first couple of years, which was great. And then I went out to Hong Kong with JP Morgan, trading convertible bonds and derivatives. And along the way at JP Morgan, I learned about risk arb trading, spread trading, tons of different arbitrage strategies. And they all, when you can start pulling strategies together, you end up building up a really good toolbox for identifying, you know, how to extract alpha from a given situation. And so that was interesting. And yeah, then I moved to Lehman Brothers. I heard the payout ratios were high and it was a fun place to work. So I jumped into that. Worked in Tokyo for a year, which was wild. You know, I think Japan's a unique place. Had great memories there. Was it like the book that you sent? What was the one
Street
that you referenced?
Freak by Jared Dillian.
I have to admit, I've not read it. It was lively. I don't think those eras coming back. So it's a fun time. I wasn't there that long. You know, for me, it was a journey. I wanted to get into the hedge fund space. Mm. And from there, I managed to find a role at Deephaven, which was quite an established hedge fund at the time out of Minnesota. They had a Hong Kong office. And then I moved to Deephaven.
Yeah.
And started trading in a hedge fund environment, which was a little bit more cerebral than Lehman Brothers. And we were then starting to do some really interesting trades around using derivatives, convertible bonds to kind of build asymmetry into an equity long short portfolio, which to this day is something I like to do when I'm trading and investing.
Yeah, that's really interesting. The convertible ARB strategy, that's something I had read in this book called How to Beat the Stock Market by Edward Thorpe. Mm-hmm. And he really talked about, you know, oftentimes the optionality of the convertible ARB is not efficiently priced. And so you can combine the convertible bond with some stock and get some sort of, you know, positive expected value. Is that really sort of the core of the strategy? That strategy seems like it's been around for a long time. Is there still edge there? Or is it been squeezed out? Is everyone aware of convertible ARB trades?
It goes in cycles. It's like the option market. But you've got a credit element to it as well. And so, you know, the convertible bond market is heavily influenced by the amount of issuance. If you get a big calendar and there's a lot of deal flow, then implied vols will get cheaper. And at that point, entering the market to buy these options is great. The only problem is in a bear market, you know, your options, the delta as it decreases, these instruments become credit instruments. And so suddenly you go from being a kind of a long gamma upside play to, you know, you've now got a kind of short gamma credit instrument on. And so, you know, whenever you're getting into a convert, the first thing you've always got to assess is the credit. You know, are you happy to own this credit with the equity down 50? And understanding that risk. If you can get comfortable with the credit, then convertible bonds are great. Then you can get into the options. But if you're mispricing the credit, the options are always going to look cheap.
Mm.
so there's, you know, it's an interesting asset class, and you really do have to understand the full picture of kind of credit spreads, equity, volatility, and then understand macro, because obviously these bonds are going to move with interest rates. So you're constantly dynamically hedging your kind of interest rate risk, your credit risk, and your equity vol risk, depending on whether you want to take on some of these risks or hedge them out.
Yeah,
so it's a great instrument for cutting your teeth on as a trader.
That's really interesting. I mean, it's a combination of, you know, various asset classes all into one trade, so it makes sense that the alpha is persistent, because there's a lot of moving parts, and different environments will make different alpha situations. That's really interesting. So, kind of closing up here, I like to close up with a couple of fun personal questions.
Sure.
I guess the top one is, you know, if anyone wanted to have a career like yours, you know, what are some lessons that you'd give out to listeners?
You know, I've had some great wins in my career, and I've had some pretty bad losses. And I think the losses are generally around choosing the partners. I think as you become a better trader and a better investor, sometimes that opportunity can blind you a little bit. So my biggest downside has generally been choosing the right partners to work with. So I'm pretty happy today at CoinShares. I've known these guys for a long time, but you know, sticking with it, you know, it takes time to get good at trading. Like, it just doesn't happen overnight. You know, you have to learn the asset class, learn the instruments, whether that's a quant strategy where you're improving your code and your logic. But then also you've got to work on yourself, you know, that kind of self-awareness for, you know, are you being reflexive to P&L swings, and kind of getting a little bit more zen about it, I think is really important. A career like mine, I wouldn't go for it. You know, I would go maybe 5-6 years, learn all about it, and then think of an adjacent business and create your own company and do a startup.
Oh, interesting. Very cool. Any books throughout your career that you'd recommend? Anyone's that influenced you a lot?
I always find Reminiscences of a Stock Operator by Edwin Lefevre is a classic. Mm-hmm. It's always a nice one to read. It's kind of, don't know if it's true or not. It's written as a memoir, but maybe not. You know, there's some great kind of heuristics you can pick up from Market Wizards. That series is always good. There's always some value in listening to these guys. And, you know, the markets may have changed a lot from when these books were first published, but the psychology remains the same. So that's interesting. And then recently I've been really spending a lot more time on my own kind of self-development and, you know, things like thinking fast and slow. How do you begin to build trading programs where you're not being influenced by your own biases? Becomes a lot more important, especially in crypto, where there's a definite absence of fundamentals. And so there's a lot of sentiment indication that comes around, whether you're reading Reddit or picking things up on Twitter, and that can easily influence you when you're making trading decisions.
Yeah.
So things like obviously Daniel Kahneman, Thinking Fast and Slow, or the Chimp Paradox is a good one.
Oh, very cool. That's an interesting point. You know, fundamentals are lacking, therefore sentiment is actually even more of a driver in crypto. Last question here.
Definitely.
What do you like to do for fun outside of work? Do you have any hobbies or anything like that?
I used to be a bit of a cyclist. I used to race around all over the world, and now I cycle recreationally. It's a little bit more lazy, a little bit of skiing, a little bit of snowboarding.
Very nice.
Pretty mellow.
Well, Lewis, thank you so much for coming on. It's super interesting. Really glad we had the chance to have you on. Thank you.
Have a good day.
Bye. See ya.